In the dying light of an autumn day in 1937, a certain Herr Edvard Juhl, a secret agent, descended from a first-class railway carriage in the city of Warsaw. Above the city, the sky was at war. The last of the sun struck blood-red embers off massed black cloud, while the clear horizon to the west was the color of blue ice.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. Author Alan First's latest spy novel is his 10th set in Europe during the 1930s and 40s. First is celebrated for his meticulous research and for his intricately plotted storytelling. His new novel, The Spies of Warsaw, concerns a hapless German engineer, a dashing French intelligence officer, a pragmatic Russian journalist, and many other players in the gathering of storm clouds that were the years leading to World War II. Alan First is often compared to novelists Graham Greene and John le Carré. He says he wants his novels to pull readers into a story that could be happening today. This reading of The Spies of Warsaw took place in June 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. What I like to say, I want to say two things about this book before I read. This is not intentional. I did not set out to do it, but this turned into be what I call my 9-10 book. This turned out to be almost contemporary, surprisingly enough, and I was simply led to that by the particular story I wanted to tell. The reason I say that is that, like all my books, everybody knows the ending. The Germans invade in 1941. You know, or in 40, or 39 and 40, and then 41 to their eternal sorrow. And the reason I call it my 9-10 book is this book is about the military attachés whose job it was to figure out where Germany was going to attack and what kind of attack it was going to be and what could be done to resist it. And, of course, I set it in Warsaw, which meant that in conversation, the French military attaché would be talking to a senior officer in Polish military intelligence who also wondered when the Germans were coming and how they were coming and just exactly what they were going to do about it. As it happened, the French military attachés knew a lot. They knew everything. They knew where, they knew how, and they kept saying to people, "It's coming. It's coming, it's coming, they're coming here, we know where," but they weren't believed, and they weren't listened to, and France lost the country. That's okay, though, because the person who stepped in to rule is the principal person who didn't believe the military attachés. Same guy, Petain. Rough justice, indeed. So the piece I'm going to read, I'm going to read you two things. I'm going to read a paragraph from a book that was written in France, in French, and is translated here. Then I'm going to read a brief passage from the beginning of the book, which describes a seduction and also a recruitment. One and the same. In this case, first the paragraph. "As looking at a portrait suggests the impression of the subject's destiny to the observer, so the map of France tells our own story. The body of the country has in its center a citadel, a forbidding mass of age-old mountains flanked by the tablelands of Provence, Limousin, and Burgundy, and all around vast slopes, for the most part difficult of access to anyone attacking them from the outside and split by the gorges of the Seine, the Rhone, and the Garonne, barred by the walls of the Jura Alps and the Pyrenees, or else plunging in the distance into the English Channel, the Atlantic, or the Mediterranean. But in the northeast, there is a terrible breach between the essential basins of the Seine and the Loire and German territory. The Rhine, which nature meant for the Gauls to have as their boundary and their protection, has hardly touched France before it leaves her and lays her open to attack." Written in 1934 by the principal intellectual of the French General Staff, Captain Charles de Gaulle. They all wrote books. Hitler wrote a book and says, here's what I'm going to do. De Gaulle wrote a book and says, here's what they're going to do. Guderian, who led the German attack, wrote a book and said, we need to have these tanks in mass. Everybody wrote a book. Everybody said what they were going to do, and then everybody did it. It's really quite just sort of astonishing. Anyhow, here's my book. And it's historical, so. In the dying light of an autumn day in 1937, a certain Herr Edvard Juhl, a secret agent, descended from a first-class railway carriage in the city of Warsaw. Above the city, the sky was at war. The last of the sun struck blood-red embers off massed black cloud, while the clear horizon to the west was the color of blue ice. Herr Juhl suppressed a shiver. The sharp air of the evening, he told himself. But this was Poland, the border of the Russian steppe, and what had reached him was well beyond the chill of an October twilight. A taxi waited on Jerusalemsky Street in front of the station. The driver, an old man with a seamed face, sat patiently, knotted hands at rest on the steering wheel. Hotel Europeski, Juhl told the driver. He wanted to add, and be quick about it. But the words would have been in German, and it was not so good to speak German in this city. Germany had absorbed the western part of Poland in 1795. Russia ruled the east, Austria-Hungary the southwest corner, for 123 years, a period the Poles called the Partition, a time of national conspiracy and defeated insurrection, leaving ample bad blood on all sides. With the rebirth of Poland in 1918, the new borders left 1 million Germans in Poland and 2 million Poles in Germany, which guaranteed that the bad blood would stay bad. So, for a German visiting Warsaw, a current of silent hostility, closed faces, small slights, we don't want you here. Nonetheless, Edvard Juhl had looked forward to this trip for weeks. In his late 40s, he combed what remained of his hair in strands across his scalp and cultivated a heavy, dark mustache meant to deflect attention from a prominent, bulbous nose, the bulb divided at the tip. A feature one saw in Poland often enough, so an ordinary-looking man who led a rather ordinary life, a more than decent life, in the small city of Breslau. A wife and 3 children, a good job, as a senior engineer at an ironworks and foundry, a subcontractor to the giant Rheinmetall firm in Dusseldorf, a few friends, memberships in a church and a singing society. Oh, maybe the political situation, that wretched Hitler and his wretched Nazis strutting about, could have been better, but one abided, lived quietly, kept one's opinions to oneself, it wasn't so difficult, and the paycheck came every week. What more could a man want? Instinctively, his hand made sure of the leather satchel on the seat by his side. A tiny stab of regret touched his heart. Foolish, Edvard, really it is. For the satchel, a gift from his first contact at the French embassy in Warsaw, had a false bottom, beneath which lay a sheaf of engineering diagrams. Well, he thought, one did what one had to do, so life went. No, one did what one had to do in order to do what one wanted to do, so life really went. He wasn't supposed to be in Warsaw. He was supposed by his family and his employer to be in Gliwice, just on the German side of the frontier, dividing German Lower Silesia from Polish Upper Silesia, where his firm employed a large metal shop for the work that exceeded their capacity in Breslau. With the Reich rearming, they could not keep up with the orders that flowed from the Wehrmacht. The Gliwice works functioned well enough, but that wasn't what Juhl told his bosses. A bunch of lazy idiots down there, he said, with a grim shake of the head, and found it necessary to take the train down to Gliwice once a month to straighten things out. And he did go to Gliwice, that pest from Breslau, back again, but he didn't stay there. When he was done bothering the local management, he took the train up to Warsaw, where, in a manner of speaking, one very particular thing got straightened out. For Yule, a blissful night of lovemaking, followed by a brief meeting at dawn, a secret meeting, then back to Breslau, back to Frau Yule and his more than decent life. Refreshed, reborn. Too much, that word? No, just right. Yule glanced at his watch. Drive faster, you peasant. This is an automobile, not a plow. The tracks he crawled along Novi Sviat, the Grand Avenue of Warsaw, deserted at this hour. The Poles went home for dinner at 4. As the taxi passed a church, the driver slowed for a moment, then lifted his cap. It was not especially reverent, Yule thought, simply something the man did every time he passed a church. At last, the imposing Hotel Europeski, with its giant of a doorman in visored cap and uniform worthy of a Napoleonic marshal. Yule handed the driver his fare and added a small proper gratuity, then said, Dankeschön. It didn't matter now. He was where he wanted to be. In the room, he hung up his suit, shirt, and tie, laid out fresh socks and underwear on the bed, and went into the bathroom to have a thorough wash. He had just enough time. The Countess Shalenska would arrive in 30 minutes. Or rather, that was the time set for the rendezvous. She would, of course, be late, would make him wait for her, let him think, let him anticipate, let him steam. And was she a countess? A real Polish countess? Probably not, he thought. But so she called herself, and she was to him like a countess, imperious, haughty, and demanding. Oh, how this provoked him. As the evening lengthened and they drank champagne, as her mood slid subtly from courteous disdain to sly submission, then on to breathless urgency. It was the same always, their private melodrama, with an ending that never changed. Yule the stallion, despite the image in the mirrored armoire, a middle-aged gentleman with thin legs and pot belly and pale chest home to a few wisps of hair, demonstrably excited as he knelt on the hotel carpet, while the Countess, looking down at him over her shoulder, eyebrows raised in mock surprise, deigned to let him roll her silk underpants down her great, saucy, fat bottom. Noblesse oblige. You may have your little pleasure, she seemed to say, if you are so inspired by what the noble Shalenska bloodline has wrought. Yule would embrace her middle and honor the noble heritage with tender kisses. In time, very effective, such honor, and she would raise him up, eager for what came next. He'd met her a year and a half earlier, in Breslau, at a wine stube where the office employees of the foundry would stop for a little something after work. The wine stube had a small terrace in back, 3 tables and a vine, and there she sat, alone at one of the tables on the deserted terrace, morose and preoccupied. He'd sat at the next table, found her attractive, not young, not old, on the buxom side, with brassy hair pinned up high and an appealing face, and said, good evening. And why so glum on such a pleasant night? She'd come down from Warsaw, she explained, to see her sister, a family crisis, a catastrophe. The family had owned for several generations a small but profitable lumber mill in the forest along the eastern border. But they had suffered financial reverses, and then the storage sheds had been burned down by a Ukrainian nationalist gang, and they'd had to borrow money from a Jewish speculator. But the problems wouldn't stop. They could not repay the loans, and now that dreadful man had gone to court and taken the mill. Just like them, wasn't it? After a few minutes, Yule moved to her table. Well, that was life for you, he'd said. Fate turned evil, often for those who least deserved it, but don't feel so bad. Luck had gone wrong, but it could go right. It always did, given time. Ah, but he was sympathique, she'd said, an aristocratic reflex to use the French word in the midst of her fluent German. They went on for a while, back and forth. Perhaps someday, she'd said, if he should find himself in Warsaw, he might telephone. There was the loveliest cafe near her apartment. Perhaps he would. Yes, business took him to Warsaw now and again. He guessed he might be there soon. Now, would she permit him to order another glass of wine? Later, she took his hand beneath the table, and he was, by the time they parted, on fire. 10 days later, from a public telephone at the Breslau railway station, he'd called her. He planned to be in Warsaw next week at the Europeski. Would she care to join him for dinner? Why, yes. Yes, she would. Her tone of voice on the other end of the phone told him all he needed to know. And by the following Wednesday, those idiots in Gliwice had done it again. He was on his way to Warsaw. At dinner, champagne and langoustine, he suggested that they go on to a nightclub after dessert. But first, he wanted to visit the room to change his tie. And so, after the cream cake, up they went. For 2 subsequent monthly visits, all was paradise. But it turned out she was the unluckiest of countesses. In his room at the hotel, brassy hair tumbled on the pillow, she told him of her latest misfortune. Now it was her landlord, a hulking beast who leered at her, made chick-chick noises with his mouth when she climbed the stairs, who told her that she had to leave, his latest girlfriend to be installed in her place, unless her misty eyes told him the rest. Never. Where Yule had just been, this swine would not go. He stroked her shoulder, damp from recent exertions, and said, Now, my dearest, calm yourself. She would just have to find another apartment. Well, in fact, she'd already done that. Found one even nicer than the one she had now, and very private, owned by a man in Krakow. So nobody would be watching her if, for example, her sweet Edvard wanted to come for a visit. But the rent was 200 zloty more than she paid now, and she didn't have it. 100 Reichsmark, he thought. Perhaps I can help, he said. And he could, but not for long. 2 months, maybe 3. Beyond that, there really weren't any corners he could cut. He tried to save a little, but almost all of his salary went to support his family. Still, he couldn't get the hulking beast out of his mind. Chuck, chuck. The blow fell a month later. The man in Krakow had to raise the rent. What would she do? What was she to do? She would have to stay with relatives or be out in the street. Now Yule had no answers. But the Countess did. She had a cousin who was seeing a Frenchman, an army officer who worked at the French embassy, a cheerful, generous fellow who, she said, sometimes hired industrial experts. Was her sweet Edvard not an engineer? Perhaps he ought to meet this man and see what he had to offer. Otherwise, the only hope for the poor Countess was to go and stay with her aunt. And where was the aunt? Chicago. Thank you.
I have a question which, unbeknownst to me, seems to tie in very nicely with your reading. That is about your female characters. How do you put them together? What do you think of them? And do you have a favorite?
Great. I've never been asked that before. I'm tongue-tied. The difficulty for me, I have known to gaze at women and try to figure out just exactly how certain faces that I like work, and why do they work that way? Some novelists will say she had a certain kind of nose, eyebrows. You cannot do that. You have to be quicker than that. So I'm always interested in women who are not glamour pusses ever. I prefer interesting-looking women, interesting for reasons no one can possibly guess. So this gives me a freer hand. I like strong women always as counterparts to my males. And there's a slew of them in here, all of them in each in her own way, very much a woman from the late 40s, but nonetheless strong in her own way. I don't know if I could do anything else. I have never tried. And that's how I do my female characters. Plus, I have to say, to the degree that they may or may not be clandestine in nature, as a number of them are in this book, the Countess Shalenska is, in fact, a Czech... She's a double character. You'll like the second Countess Shalenska as well. Believe me. Yes, the next question.
How much do you research? Do you just read, you know, narrative histories, or do you read first-person accounts? Do you try to get every detail right, or once you're sort of inhabiting that world, do you sort of leave it to intuition?
I try to get every detail right, and you would be amazed at the stuff that winds up on the cutting room floor. It's terrific, but it just can't be used. And this happens with every book. What I use are soon after the fact encyclopedic histories. I have a 51 Britannica. Because what happens with encyclopedias is that as they gain, even though they gain 2 or 3 or 4 years after an event, like the Second World War, their focus is still very much on the world in which that war took place. It's no good to me to read something written in 75. By then it's gone. So that's one thing I do. I read present-day histories of the period. I like to read immediate histories written right away. I like to read personal accounts, of which there are many when war is coming. I also like to read journalists' books. It's still written, really. It used to be when a person became a foreign correspondent, they'd spend 3 years in Romania, and they'd go back to London, and they'd write a book called Fire Over Bucharest. It was always fire over somewhere. Wherever they'd been. Those are wonderful accounts. And they all say the same thing. War is coming, we ought to stop it. All say the same thing. Hundreds of them. This one particular guy has a... I don't know. I think I did get this into one of the books. I think it's in Blood of Victory, but I'm not sure. He met a young woman one night and went out drinking with her, and they went back to her apartment. When he came home in the morning, he discovered that somebody in the apartment below had fired a pistol through the floor and up through his mattress into the ceiling. Good night to stay out. Yes, sir.
I was wondering what it is about this period that you like to write about. Is there some personal reason? And also, what other periods would you, if you didn't write about this, that you would be interested in doing?
Okay, I'll answer it backwards. No other periods.
Okay.
I like only this period in the same way that some people like only Haagen-Dazs fudge ripple. They're not interested. Well, it is like that. They're not interested in raspberry whatever. It's just not. I have two answers. I've added a new answer to that question. I like the period as a novelist because it is unquestionably good versus evil. There's no question about that. So when somebody agrees to be a spy or an underground operative or joins the resistance, there's no question in your heart that he's doing the wrong thing by fighting Hitler or even by fighting Stalin. I like it for that reason. Plus the fact that this was a time when the world or Europe really had it out as to what kind of world was it going to be. Was it going to be a totalitarian, authoritarian, brutal world where everything was secure and quiet and everybody had just barely enough to eat? Or was it going to be a messy world of freedom? And the French and the Brits on one side, for as long as the French lasted, and the Germans on the other side, Japanese, Italy, you know, to whatever degree, had that out. Now I'll give you another answer that's much harder. But there are people in here who will understand exactly what I mean, and there are people here who won't. It's simply a question of how well you know music. But I will say that one of the things about the period that I really fasten on is this. During this period of time, in the middle 30s, you have both the Adagio by Samuel Barber and Django Reinhardt and Stefan Grappelli. I hope those of you who know what I'm talking about appreciate that, because that really is a perfect definition of why I like the period. Yes, sir.
One of the 500 or so things that I really like about your books
is you've
managed to create a series that's held together by a historical period and an atmosphere, and the protagonists change with virtually every book. What made you do that?
well, I wanted to write a series, but I didn't want to write about the same character again and again, because what you have with the same character again and again is a sort of a lot of moral dithering. You know, I mean, you just get that. You have the same character. You know his or her weaknesses, strengths, et cetera, and so forth. But now he's worried about this, and he's thinking about that, and should he really stay in the business, and blah, 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 and who gives a shit? You know, that was always the weakness that I felt. A. B, I really like to watch the development of the main character in a book, and he could die. Since he's not your series character, you may just decide to the end of the book, out. I don't happen to do that, but could happen. However, I love private worlds. Faulkner, Yucknapatawpha County, Anthony Pohl, Tory Britain, you know, between the wars, etc. and so forth. I love private worlds built as fiction. Just like, you know, baseball leagues that kids have where they have batting averages and the names and all the teams, etc. and so forth. So I decided that I wanted to build a private world, and that meant that it would have to have characters who recurred that I liked, that other people liked. It has places that recur. It has all kinds of recurring things to make it a series. The ship that brings the lead character to Ostend in Dark Star is blown up by the hero of the Polish officer later on. And there are people who watch that. And then there's many, many more instances of this kind of stuff going on. So that if you like to read closely and keep track, you can. Yes?
One thing that I'm struck by your books is that the first few are quite epic and panoramic. And then as each new book comes out, they become more like portraiture. And I'm wondering, are you watching that, or is this
I changed planned? At The World at Night. I had set out to write one panoramic spy novel.
Which was magnificent.
Thank you.
Love it. It's my favorite still.
Thank you. You're not the only one. It is what I set out to do, and to be rich for the rest of my life.
We hope that
half happens. Of the plan worked out. So I did it again, as in, get it? I'm, you know, like, yoo-hoo. And I wrote my Jewish novel, Dark Star. And once again, it was a success d'estime, but not a success d'Alain. So I did it one more time, this time with a Polish officer, which is very different than all the other books for certain kinds of reasons. I was under a huge emotional overdrive writing that book, and the result is what the result is. And then after that, I decided I don't want to quite try to do this anymore because I'm going to run out of material. And I don't like the four novella form, which is what I was doing. I was writing novellas. I can't write a novel. But I couldn't write a lot of novellas about the same thing and stick them all together, and the publisher would do the rest, would bind it as a book. So that's what I did, and that's why the change. Meanwhile, since then, they've all been the same length. Absolutely the same length. A lot of other writers do that. I just found out Robert Parker delivers his manuscripts at 308 pages. Not nine, not seven. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi. You and the British director, Carol Reed, would have got along famously, I think. But is there any particular espionage episode of World War II that you haven't focused on that would make a good novel? And what about that situation where the British torpedoed, sent a body onto the coast of Greece and made the...
The man who never was.
Right, made the Germans think that the invasion was coming in a different
place. They did many things. Yeah. But again, you never know with that kind of stuff. There's a famous story that probably I won't use. A courier, German courier, crashed in a small plane in Belgium, I think, a couple of months before the 39 invasion of Poland, or even in 1940. He had all the war plans in a briefcase. And the French and the British thought he was the man who never was, that he was there to mislead them. I don't know that there's anything particular I would write about. I think the most important special operation of the war was the sinking of the ship with heavy water in Norway. No question about that, because it stopped Hitler's nuclear ambitions. There's nothing even close. So, I mean, that was a good one. I don't see writing about it. It doesn't have the particular dramatic stuff that I like. Yes?
I was wondering, your novels are, for me anyway, quite intricate and in detail and so on. I wondered how you put your plots together. How does that evolve?
I'm not able to. I can't write a plot.
I can't
write a plot. If I tried to write a plot, it comes out sounding like a plot. Oh, a plot. Then he does this, and he's thwarted. But she tells him a way that he can succeed, and he tries it. Ugh.
So how do you put your stories? Do you just
They're
write?
They're all true. You want a novelist? Try history.
Right.
A beastly novelist. Brutal. But fabulous. I never write a plot. What I do is I learn the national history of a country. And from the national history, once I know it and I know the political history, I know how to go looking for the spy story that must of necessity accompany the political realities of that country at the time. It has to. Logically, it has to. And there's always one. It's sometimes very hard to find. This one was in my head for a long time. I thought, all these people wrote books. Isn't that incredible? De Gaulle, et cetera, and so forth. And the more I read about De Gaulle, you know, he's a phenomenally interesting person. The stuff I left out of here, including terrifying letters about fighting in the Bekaa Valley, terrifying only in that it could come out of yesterday's New York Times, and his statement that we're never going to get this done here. These people aren't going to change. 1932, Charles de Gaulle fighting the Don Dash in the Bekaa Valley. Okay? So what I did was I took de Gaulle's life as a shadow life and had another character who kind of lived the same sort of life. And that's how I do the plots. All the plots are the same. I can't make up wonderful things. Other writers can, but I can't. Hey, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.